Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Our nation's conversation about marriage is changing. Evidence of that comes in Newsweek magazine, where a recent My Turn column written by Bonnie Esslinger is about why she says that she wants to say yes to love and no to marriage. The subtitle of her article is this: I'm committed to Jeff for life. I just don't need a piece of paper and a pretty white dress to prove it. Now, that particular argument is gathering a lot of controversy. As a matter of fact, it has actually ricocheted into other journals and online sources where there's a pretty furious debate over Ms. Esslinger's argument. We're going to come back and talk about it today, because whether you are hearing this in this form right now, whether you're hearing the argument coming just this way right now, you're going to be hearing it. I'm hearing it. Now, people are saying, look, what's the big deal about marriage? Commitment's the big issue. You don't have to have marriage in order to have commitment. We're going to be talking about it today on the Albert Mohler Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some of the issues in the news. It turns out that this has been a very interesting few days. Of course, you have President Bush in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, and headed for Egypt. He has been in Israel as well. A lot of attention to that. There is news also coming out indicating, for instance, that when Americans are considering spirituality, they're talking about less and less rather than more and more. USA Today is out with an article by Jeffrey McDonald. It begins this way: 2 weeks into the new year, life in the USA is largely back to normal. That means time is scarce, stress is high, and an ordinary day filled with chatter and utter noise permits barely a moment for the mind to rest in silence. Now, the interesting thing about Mr. McDonald's article is that he is writing about spirituality as a replacement for organized religion, in particular here, Christianity in the main. People who say, I want to be spiritual, but I don't consider myself religious. A survey released last week, according to USA Today, and the survey done by Lifeway Research, says that even people who haven't attended religious services in 6 months say that at the rate of 72%, they nevertheless believe that there is a God or higher power. The survey also indicated that 86% said they can have a good relationship with God without belonging to a church. Now, I find several things interesting about this. Part of it is the fact that USA Today thinks this is news, that this isn't news at all. This is as old as America. This is Ralph Waldo Emerson. This is Henry David Thoreau. This is American transcendentalism. This is the American project of inventing the self as a spiritual being without any accountability to truth claims, to the disciplines of the Christian life, to a church, any ongoing responsibility. Henry David Thoreau, you know, obviously made famous Walden Pond, where he said he was in touch with the Creator, more in touch than he would be in church. Ralph Waldo Emerson talking about the new American who would live by his interior life, unaccountable to external authorities, and would redefine himself as a new spiritual being. The interesting thing about both Thoreau and Emerson is that this meant the overthrow of Orthodox and traditional Christianity. But it also means, as the historian Winthrop Hudson had indicated, this means a church under every man's hat. In other words, this is just another form of rugged American individualism, but this time under the guise of spirituality. Now, let me give you a little evidence for that right out of the USA Today article. This is what it says: whether religious or secular in nature, an inner life blossoms as its four key components are purposefully cultivated. These involve, now listen to this, taking time for quiet and solitude, cultivating some type of regular spiritual practice or discipline, grounding this spiritual practice in the support of a community, bringing reflection and heightened awareness to everything you do, on and on and on. Now let me ask you, is bringing reflection and heightened awareness to everything you do a new thought? Do we really believe that Americans are finding greater fulfillment in washing the dishes and mowing the lawn and doing the other things of life than ever before? No, I think what this is another form of American consumerism. We can now package this as a new lifestyle, and we can reinvent it in every generation and call it something new. And in this case, the new label is spirituality. Spirituality. I'm a spiritual person, just not religious. Some educators are concerned about the Internet and its impact on education. Tara Brasbedon, who is a professor at the University of Brighton in England, says that Google is, I love her term for this, white bread for the mind. Now, that's an insult to white bread. The idea there is that it has no nutrition. Basically, it's just cheap and fluffy and airy and, you know, meant to be made into a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But it's not real bread. The real bread would be whole grain bread, something you'd buy down at the organic bread store. It's an insult to white bread becoming here a metaphor for everything that's cheap and bourgeois and suburban and to be expected. Frankly, as a kid that grew up on Wonder Bread, I find that offensive. But nonetheless, that's not the central part of her argument. Her argument is that the Internet is this superficiality and it's a diet of the artificial. This is what she says. In her inaugural lecture at the University of Brighton, she's going to urge teachers at all levels of the education system to equip students with the skills they need to interpret and sift through information gleaned from the Internet. Listen to this. She believes that easy access to information has dulled students' sense of curiosity and is stifling debate. She claims that many undergraduates arrive at university unable to discriminate between anecdotal and unsubstantiated material posted on the Internet. She says that she calls this type of education the University of Google. Now, I agree and disagree with her. Number one, I don't think that Google and the Internet stifle creativity and interest and curiosity. If anything, I think it raises the level of curiosity. And just in case you're wondering about this, just go and find out what your student is Googling about, if you dare. Because you're likely to find out it's a stream of consciousness of all kinds of things. I find Google absolutely indispensable if I'm looking up something. Because the first thing you can do is put it in Google and check it out either on the website or in news sites and all the rest. But I do think this professor is onto something when she suggests that students are finding it very difficult to discriminate between authoritative and non-authoritative information. And that really does get to a crucial issue. You know, the discipline of getting something written and actually published in a book that actually makes its way into a library or a bookstore is very different than the discipline or lack of discipline of being able to post something on the Internet and people think it's real. And this is something that you don't really perhaps think about every day, but you just take a newspaper, for example. If you go back in American history 50 years, and let's say there's a major American newspaper, the New York Times. You look in the New York Times, you know what it is. It's called the old gray lady for a good reason. It is the old establishment newspaper. You look at the typeface, you look at the quality of the print, you look at the way it's edited and the way it's written. It just cries out authoritative, elitist means of communication. Then you think of a couple of kids, let's say a couple of high school students who are putting out a newspaper. 50 years ago, what are they doing? At the very latest technology, maybe they have a mimeograph machine. And maybe they have access to some kind of crude printing press. But the look of it would be enough to cry out, this isn't the same thing. One's authoritative, one's not. The writing would then reveal it. The editing would then reveal it. You wouldn't have to have a great deal of sophistication to tell the difference between the one and the other. That world is different because on the Internet, sometimes the people with the least intellectual ability have the greatest graphic and creative ability, depending on the subject matter. And so you really have to develop exactly what this professor is calling for, and that is some discernment. I do find it interesting, however, that she would refer to Google as white bread for the mind. You know, every once in a while, white bread's not that bad a thing. Nancy Kalish, writing in the New York Times, says, if you find it difficult to get your teenager up for high school in the morning, it might be because the high school's starting too early. It turns out the research, which we've known for some time, indicates that teenagers' body clocks are set to a schedule that is different to that of young children or adults. This prevents adolescents from dropping off until about 11 p.m. when they produce the sleep-inducing hormone melatonin and waking up much before 8 o'clock a.m. when their bodies stop producing the same chemical. The result is that the first class of the morning is often a waste, listen to this, with as many as 28% of students falling asleep. Very interesting data here. The high schools in Jessamine County in Kentucky pushed back the first bell to 8:40 a.m. when it had been 7:30 a.m. Attendance immediately went up, as did scores on standardized tests, which have continued to rise each year. School districts who have not made this kind of change say it's because of cost. the cost of changing bus schedules, difficulty of adjusting after-school activity schedules, inconvenience to teachers and parents. This is interesting, and I can tell you, as one who works with college and graduate students, this evidently continues a great deal beyond the teenage years. We're going to be back to talk about marriage and why it matters. There is a constituency in this country that is saying, look, we don't need marriage. All we need is commitment. We're going to come back and talk about a Christian response to that argument. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 877-8-GOLD-101.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Marriage is hardly a new issue. It's hardly a new controversy. But the current controversy is taking on a different kind of shade. I think this controversy, as reflected in Newsweek magazine in recent days, is really only explicable because the whole question of marriage is now up for grabs in this culture. With same-sex marriage proposals and all the rest, a no-fault divorce, the redefinition of marriage in our age, it's left some people with an opening to make an argument that in previous generations would have been unthinkable. The argument is made by Bonnie Esslinger in her My Turn column in Newsweek magazine. It's entitled, Yes to Love, No to Marriage. The subtitle, I'm Committed to Jeff for Life, I Just Don't Need a Piece of Paper and a Pretty White Dress to Prove It. She says this, I'm a 42-year-old woman who has lived life mostly on my own terms. I've never sought a husband and have still experienced intense affirming love. I have explored the world and myself and sought understanding, knowledge, and a sense of how I can best contribute. 10 years ago, I left a New York career to return to California and pursue a writer's life. Shortly thereafter, I met an intelligent teenager, also determined to live life on her terms, who is now my fabulous foster daughter. Meeting Jeff, an intelligent, creative, thoughtful man, became the icing on the rich cake of a life not wasted, cruising singles bars and pining over lost loves. Last year, Jeff asked me to marry him, and I willingly gave my heart to the intent of his question. We are committed to spending our future together, pursuing our dreams, and facing life's challenges in partnership. Yet I do not need a piece of paper from the state to strengthen my commitment to Jeff. I do not believe in a religion that says romantic committed love is moral only if couples pledge joint allegiance to God. I don't need a white dress to feel pretty, and I have no desire to pretend I'm virginal. I don't need to have Jeff propose to me as if he's chosen me. I don't need a ring as a daily reminder to myself or others that I am loved. And I don't need Jeff to say publicly that he loves me because he says it privately, not just in words, but in daily actions. Now, it's really interesting that she writes that her difficulty is getting her own family to understand this. Her neighbors and co-workers, I guess, would be included in the larger circle of those who may be scratching their heads, wondering why she's not married. She also believes that her gay friends ought to be entitled to the same benefits as a married person. She says that she believes the value of relationships shouldn't be determined by law and the affirmation of others, but basically just between the partners. Now, it may be that this is a new argument to you, but I want to tell you it's something I've been picking up on in the culture for some time. As a matter of fact, even on some college and university campuses, I've had students come up to me and say, look, we want to be committed to each other, but where in the Bible does it say we have to be married? Where in the Bible does it say you have to have a wedding? Where in the Bible does it say you have to have a marriage license and a marriage certificate? Where in the Bible does it say that you have to do all these things? Well, that's the reason why we're having this conversation today, because we need to talk about what the Bible does and doesn't say, and we need to understand again why the Christian worldview establishes an entire universe of meaning in which marriage has a very important, even a central part, and why marriage for us is more than a white dress, a piece of paper, a golden ring, and all the rest. All of that is not in the Bible. In the Bible, it doesn't say anything about a white dress. It doesn't say anything about, you know, a wedding ring. It doesn't say anything about a marriage certificate or a marriage license. Those are modern inventions that in our society are just a part of what it means to formalize what is in the Bible. which is the public establishment of a covenant of the man and woman before God, making a pledge, a series of pledges, but most importantly, the pledge that they'll be committed to each other as husband and wife for the entirety of their lives. That is what's missing from Miss Esslinger's article here. She says that she can have commitment without all of this. Now, she's the one who's making the argument. So in making the argument in a public place, she opens the argument for criticism. And it has received criticism. It's also received affirmation at Salon.com. That's a prominent website, web magazine, read by a lot of people in this culture, primarily from the cultural left. Carol Lloyd writes, affirming what Miss Esslinger wrote. She writes this. She says that the anger over the Esslinger article shows how threatening anti-marriage talk still is. She says this, her article doesn't seem terribly radical. It's something that could have been written decades ago, and she mentioned some feminist writings. She goes on and says, my beliefs about marriage don't diverge much from Esslinger's, though I'm a certified viable Mrs. for something so exclusionary and heavy with misogynist baggage. I reason, shouldn't this legal spiritual love bond at least perform better as a bonding substance than our 50% divorce rates suggest? Well, he goes on and she goes on and on talking about this. She says, in the end, I decided if individuals actually believe in marriage, it's a beautiful thing. But for me, marriage is more about other people's ideas, legal protections, and extended family traditions. I stumbled through the rite of passage with the same dazed ambivalence felt by many people when buying their first home. So here you have one woman who says, I'm not getting married because I don't want all of that. I don't need all of that. You have another woman saying, I basically agree with her, but I actually went through with it because it was just easier given family and legal issues and all the rest. Now, at Newsweek's site, there is a furious discussion going back and forth on this as well. Meanwhile, CNN reports just about at the same time that 4.6 million U.S. households were occupied by unmarried couples of the opposite sex. That's up from 2.9 million in just 1996. So there's a tremendous increase in cohabitation. Evidently, a lot of people are buying the argument made by Ms. Esslinger in Newsweek magazine. Are you buying it? What's your response to it? In other words, when someone comes along and says that they can have commitment without marriage, do we have a good argument to give them in response? I'd love to hear how you're going to come up with it. I'm going to suggest some things we ought to include in that argument, how we ought to frame that argument. But it would be helpful to have some input from those of you who are having to deal with this, maybe in your own family, in your own church, in your own circle of acquaintances. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Now, since Ms. Esslinger did write this article, by the way, it's supposed to be written as a first-person article. After all, the title of the column in Newsweek is My Turn. But I want to point out that in the very construction of her article, she really betrays what's going on here. She doesn't really talk about we. It's about me. It's not about us. It's about I. I mean, if you look at the pronouns in her article, it's I thought, I'm a 42-year-old woman. I've never sought a husband. I've explored the world in myself. I can best contribute. I left a New York career. I met an intelligent teenager. I willingly gave my heart, she says, to the intent of her partner Jeff's question. I do not need a piece of paper. I do not believe in a religion that says romantic committed love is moral only if couples pledge joint allegiance to God. I don't need a white dress to feel pretty. I have no desire to pretend I'm virginal. I don't need to have Jeff propose to me. I don't need a ring. I don't need to prove to others I'm loved. I don't need Jeff to say anything publicly. There's just a whole lot of I here. You know, I think part of the problem is that if we define the world in terms of our own personal autonomy, if our worldview begins with just our own isolated self, and if we use our own self-determined guideline to come up with what we need, what we like, what we want, what we don't need, what we don't want, we just might come up with something like this. I'm going to suggest that a part of the reason why marriage is important is because marriage is the transformation, not just of the couple, but of the entire question from I to we. From, for that matter, just the couple, even to the larger society. What do we owe to each other? I'm going to argue that we owe making our commitments publicly, making marriage a permanent institution, and making it something that you can't just get in and out of in convenience. Because that's exactly what you get with cohabitation. And that is no divorce when you split up. You just move out. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with your calls.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Let's go to Clashad calling from Omaha, Nebraska, listening on KCRO. Go ahead, Clashad.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me, first of all, coming up with this topic. I was just going to say that I do believe that the church should hold us accountable to have marriage in public ceremonies. And I think what it comes down to is Christ dying on the cross. If that was done in private, we wouldn't have been able to see the love that God has for us. And since his word does tell us that he is love, I think that that's something that needs to be done in order to edify the body.
Clashad, let me ask you, are you married?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, now let me suggest to you that I have the power here for a moment, which I do not have, to give you Newsweek's My Turn column for next week to answer Buddy Esslinger. Would you want to take that on?
Sure, for whatever the Lord puts on my heart to say.
Yeah, but what you would say is that you do believe that marriage is important because it is a public commitment, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. I really do appreciate that, because that's what I wish we might have as an answer to this, that would say, look, I believe it's a public commitment. The public commitment is what's so necessary here, because without that public commitment, it's not really an institution anymore. It's just a cohabitation. It's just an alignment of two souls, using the kind of romantic language you kind of see used here. You know, I have a couple of things that have happened to me even recently. I had a pastor tell me not long ago that he had happen what I had happened when I was in college, and that is to come across a young couple that said, well, we're married. We think we're married. We got married because, well, we were alone, and in the heat and ardor of the moment, we didn't want to commit fornication. So we simply said to God, we want to be married, and they were supposedly married. You see, the reality is, though, they're not married. There is no public commitment made. No one knows they're married. It's a publicly declared relationship. In the history of civilization, a part of the necessity of marriage, even a part of the utility of the wedding ceremony, is so that the exclusive identification of the spouses with each other is now a public act. For another man now to try to be romantic toward this woman is a violation of social trust. For this man, in the husband of the relationship, to try to develop a relationship with a woman other than his wife is a violation of social trust and social mores. That's a part of the reason why this is so important. A couple of other things that come to mind about this have to do with the husband. As some of the responders to Bonnie Esslinger's article, her My Turn column, have mentioned, where's Jeff here? Where's Jeff's voice? If Jeff were writing his own column, would he write it the way that Bonnie has written it? After all, Bonnie tells us that he asked her to marry him. She says that she said yes to the intent of the question rather than to the question. You know, I think of what George Gilder has written years ago in his book Men in Marriage. He writes that in the history of marriage, marriage is not primarily about keeping a woman committed to the relationship. It's primarily about keeping a man committed to the relationship. Because of the proneness that it seems is apparent for men to wander from the relationship. I think there's a lot of wisdom in there, as a matter of fact. Let's go to Johnny calling from Knoxville, Tennessee, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Johnny.
Yes, Dr. Mohler. I love your program.
Oh, thank you.
The only comment I would have is the difference between a covenant before God and a cohabitational contract between two different individuals. Because they can always have in the back of their mind that, okay, this doesn't work out. I'm not liable. I can move on. Whereas a spiritual contract before God, two different individuals coming together, swearing emotionally, physically, spiritually, and mentally, all that they can do within their will, within God's eyes and with God's help for them to do that. See, there's a difference between that and two people deciding that, hey, we're going to try to do this together.
That's a very, very good point, Johnny, and a point powerfully made. You know, I think of the very words of the Christian wedding ceremony just to verify your statement here. I mean, after all, having conducted these so many times, I hear myself saying, you know, we are in the presence of God and these witnesses. And we talk about how God has solemnized this occasion and blessed this occasion. I think that's really, really important, because it's about the Creator saying, I made you for this. This is the covenant institution I made for your good. I bless the fact that you as husband and wife are entering it, and you are entering it making a commitment for life. Short of that, whatever you call it, it's not marriage. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I have to get back to where I was before with the personal pronoun. I. You know, that's really one of the big misunderstandings about marriage. Marriage isn't even just about the two. It's not even just about the married pair, the husband and the wife. Marriage is about all of us. Marriage is about the entire institution, the entire civilization. Marriage is about the children and the generations to come. Marriage is about an institution that protects not only, specifically, the husband and the wife, but not only the husband and the wife, but the integrity of the entire civilization. The phone number is 877-893-8255, and we'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 877-8-GOLD-101.
You know, in reality, marriage has been subverted all around us, no-fault divorce being the main form of subversion. The entire culture really militates against the strengthening of marriage, even though all kinds of authorities cry out about the marriage crisis. Most of the trends in our society are those that undermine marriage rather than strengthen it. And now with the whole threat of redefining marriage, even in terms of gender for same-sex marriage, and giving up marriage altogether as an expectation. You know, one of the things we're going to be talking about in coming days on this program is the suggestion being made by some who claim to be evangelicals, they identify themselves as evangelical Christians, that we need to just give in on the same-sex marriage issue by retaining marriage as a church institution, asking the state just to forget about marriage, and letting the state just bless any civil union. Now, by the way, most of those proposals are very thin, you know, not with many specifics. You get on the specifics there, even those who favor such a proposal have difficulty, I think, coming up with how to pull it off. But there is just a continual marginalization and subversion of marriage. We have to make the case going the other way. If we really do believe in marriage, we not only have to answer those out there in the media and in the public square, but, of course, Bonnie Esslinger in her Newsweek article that's getting so much attention. We've got callers on the line from all over the country to join the conversation. Call 877-893-8255. We're going to get to as many calls as we can. Let's go first to Cary, North Carolina. Lisa's listening on XM170. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yes, hi. One of the things that I think has been very detrimental to marriage has been contraception, because it has one of the main purposes of marriage is to have children and to have a family. And I think since the acceptance of contraception among Christians back in the 1930s, that element has been removed. And without the children, which used to be a main focus of marriage, marriage can now be whatever you want. Like you said, it could just be two people that just want to have a good time together, companionship. And people don't even look at that element of children anymore, because contraception has really made it optional. And children, instead of being a blessing, have many times been looked at as a burden, something that needed to be controlled.
Lisa, just an excellent series of points you've made there. As a matter of fact, marriage has always been defined in ways that imply children are coming, in order to define the identity of the children. Who's responsible for the children? Who these children belong to, so to speak? And the whole institution of marriage is, well, as Will and Ariel Durant, the historians, would put it, and they weren't evangelical Christians, they had no axe to grind there. It's, as they said, kind of a fire break, which is necessary for civilization, lest unbridled romance, lust, sexuality just burn over the civilization. I think that's what we're in danger of. Lisa mentioned contraception. You know, I've written so much on this, I've gotten a lot of heat on this. I continue to get angry mail about this all the time. I do believe that marriage implies, at the very minimum, the absolute openness to children and the intention to have children. And the contraceptive mentality has become a way of redefining this. Interesting, you know, most American Protestants would be shocked to know, non-Roman Catholic Christians, be shocked to know that virtually every denomination that had any position on contraception, and most of them did one way or another, just to go back 50 years, were solidly against it. It's only in recent years that there has been a contraceptive mentality that has taken root, not only in the culture, but also among many people in the church. Seeing children, it's not just the use of contraceptives, it's the mentality that is implied that children are now an accessory. an afterthought, perhaps, a strategic decision rather than part of the marriage itself. Thanks for the call there from North Carolina. Let's go to Salem, Oregon, where Misty's listening on KPJC. Go ahead, Misty.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Mueller. You brought in an excellent point earlier that I caught, that essentially I think the main reason that people don't want the commitment and the piece of paper is because of the accountability, because it is in front of their neighbors, and they want the ability to do whatever they want without anybody saying anything. And the other point that I noticed that more and more prevalent, more than I've ever seen before, are TV's promotion of the living together rather than getting married. I've never seen so many times where a woman to a woman is having a conversation, and one woman will say to the other, well, gee, you've been with this guy for a year. Aren't you guys going to live together? Are you afraid of commitment?
Yeah, wow, what a zinger there, Misty. Are you afraid of commitment? Yeah, I mean, afraid's not the word, I think, here. Resistant, and you implied that with your first statement. There's a resistance to accountability, a resistance to a public covenant that would knowingly be broken. You see, in the case of this woman who wrote this article, Bonnie Esslinger, and Jeff, her partner, she doesn't give his last name, you put the two of them together, she says, and I want to read this strategic part of the article again, she says, last year Jeff asked me to marry him, and I willingly gave my heart to the intent of his question. We are committed to spending our future together, pursuing our dreams, and facing life's challenges in partnership. Well, for how long? I mean, this implies an ongoing responsibility there, but there's no accountability there because there's no one that has to be brought into the equation from outside the couple as a matter of accountability. And as lax as our divorce laws are, and we must do everything we can to try to reverse that trend, as lax as the divorce culture has led so many people to be, there still has to be some outside agent to be brought in for this union to be dissolved, even if it's just a judge. And, of course, in the case of Bonnie and Jeff, that won't be necessary at all. No public accountability whatsoever. Misty, excellent point. Thanks so much for calling from Salem, Oregon. Let's go to Drake, North Dakota, where Brad's listening on XM 170. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Mueller. I think it's very important for us to remember that the institution of marriage was one that goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 2, where God created Eve for Adam because no suitable helper was found, and created that institution. And in the act of marriage, we become one flesh, not two. Out of all of this, this is Mary. It's obvious rejection of God in American culture in what she's saying, because it's a picture of our relationship with Christ and the church in our marriage.
Yeah, just to affirm what you're saying, Brad, she's pretty explicit about this. Let me read one sentence from her article. She says, I do not believe in a religion that says romantic committed love is moral only if couples pledge joint allegiance to God. Well, you know, there are many things people can debate about Scripture, but all the important things are settled. And among those extremely important, urgently important things is what marriage is. It's not that you have to look far in the Bible to find it. You just go as far as Genesis 2, second chapter of the Bible, and you're there. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. It's one thing to hear this kind of argument out there in the secular world, whether it's Newsweek or Salon.com, any of those places. You can kind of expect this in a secular conversation. But what has alarmed me in some recent days is that I've heard similar arguments, not quite the same argument, but similar arguments coming from some Christians, especially as I think there is a fatigue among some Christians in dealing with the whole marriage issue, simply because it looks like the culture of no-fault divorce is about as invincible as a glacier right now, just, absolutely ensconced and established within the culture and within its worldview and mindset. And with the contentious debates over same-sex marriage and all the rest, it really is becoming an issue of fatigue for many Christians. I want to come back and say that marriage really is so important that we better fight for it. We better contend for it, define it, teach it. And one of the things we need to make very clear is that, yes, the Bible says nothing about a white dress and a golden ring, nothing about invitations and a reception that has to be held in order for there to be a marriage. But it does make very clear that it is a public ceremony. And as a matter of fact, that Jesus performed, of course, his very first miracle, the wedding at Cana of Galilee. And you have all the things there. It's a public declaration. The covenant being made by this couple before God as a way of saying to the entire community, we now belong to each other. There is sexual monogamy here. There is exclusivity here. There's a bond here that all must respect. You see, that's what's lacking without marriage. And so when you talk about the marriage certificate and the marriage ceremony, those are just ways in our society, as in, frankly, most other societies, you find your way towards a recognition that this really is a marriage, that this pledge really has been made, that this couple really does deserve this kind of respect, that the relationship really does represent this kind of exclusivity. You know, I don't think anyone who is focusing on the dress and the ring and the certificate and all the rest and saying, I don't want all that, so I'm not going to get married. I don't think that they're even being honest about the real issue here. The real issue, I think, is the public accountability. It's not a ring. It's not a certificate. It's not a reception. It's the accountability. And that's why we, in this postmodern age, where so many Americans are completely committed to their own personal autonomy, that's why we have to continually come back and say, whenever our argument about something as important as marriage is couched in the kind of prose that line after line speaks of I this and I that, we already have a problem. Because the purpose of our existence does not come well down to that single pronoun, the first person singular. It has to be a lot bigger than that. At the very least, it's never just about us in the Christian worldview perspective. It's first of all about our Creator. Then us, but we are not isolated individuals. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. We're going to talk about whether it would matter if a woman serves as President of the United States.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.